مردمی و حتی در خدمت یکی از بزرگان فارس است. در متن تاریخ طبری، شیرین کنیزکی است به صورت و سیرت نیکوتر از صاحبان خیش، نیکوتر از همه مردمان ترکمان.
Join CITR's Nardwar the Human Serviette live as he talks and plays interview clips from his audio and video vault. The event is free and takes place on Friday, January 17th from noon to 2 p.m. in room 212A of the AMS Student Union building at UBC. For more information, visit CITR.ca or Nardwar.com.
Bless up! Nardwar!
Hi, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. It is 6 o'clock Pacific Standard Time. You are listening to Are You Aware? I'm Sarah Lapsley, and I'm filling in for Fleur, who is the regular host of Are You Aware? She's away. She's been away in Australia for a few weeks. So this is the second time I'm filling in, and I had an amazing time last time. And I enjoyed the mandate of the show, which is just playing music that's related to social change and awareness. And last time I was like, oh, what kind of music, you know, is about social change? So much of it is just kind of, frankly, like a lot of rock. It's just about self-expression and artistic expression or love. And those are good things. But I think I've been more into the idea of music as a force for social change. And I think last time I mentioned like, oh, you know, you think of folk music or world music. And then after I left, I was like, punk rock. Like, that's what it's all about. So I kind of had this idea of playing tribute to punk rock as an agent of social change. And then also just psychopaths. And I'll tell you sort of how I came to kind of link those two together on a few different ways. So the first part of the show, I guess we're going to talk about punk rock. And then talk about psychopaths, and then maybe talk a little bit about climate change at the end, because there's a lot of evidence, I would say, of climate change happening, and it's impacting people, and we're really dumb to sully our own nest, you could say. But when it comes to punk rock, I have to say I know very little about it, really, historically. And I sort of claimed on my Facebook page I was pulling out the stops, and I really wanted to, but I have a full-time job now, 9 to 5. If you've never had a full-time job, I don't know if I recommend it. It's like sucks the life out of you. You just like wake up and you're like, oh, where am I? Oh my God, I have to go to work again. And then at the end of the day, you're like so tired you can't do anything except maybe make a meal or have a bath, and then you go to sleep to get up to work again. Your coworkers are like, you're like married to your coworkers. Like, your menstrual cycles align. You know what they ate the day before, even though, you know, they haven't told you. But there's perks too, I guess. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is, like, I'm not as prepared as I hoped. And I know there's some good documentaries out there about punk rock, and I didn't watch them, even though I wanted to. And I wanted to watch, oh, that movie Thatcher with Meryl Streep, just to give me some context for what Britain was like and how punk rock came out of that. But I didn't do those things, so, and I know maybe people are listening that know a lot more than I do about punk rock, so I won't insult you by claiming to know. I will just celebrate the beauty of punk rock with shout-outs to bands you know, in various parts of the world. So first, let's talk about British punk rock. So unemployment, social unrest in the late 70s. Quote, punk's nihilistic swagger was the most thrilling thing in England. And so I guess what I'm gathering was that there were a couple of different types of punk rock that emerged. So a nihilistic outlook, no future, sort of from the Sex Pistols. outlook. And then there was also a radical leftist utopianism of bands such as Crass, who were more positive and actively engaging in social change. So we're going to play some of that, but The Clash is fun. Everybody loves The Clash. And they're kind of more in the middle. I don't think they were necessarily really proactively engaged, but they weren't that nihilistic either. And in fact, they kind of, correct me if I'm wrong, became more mainstream over time. And I think in his later years, Joe Strummer was involved in philanthropy and stuff, but more like, you know, less in a grassroots way, because by that point he was quite established. So I guess I'm just going to kick it off by playing some Clash before we dig a little deeper into Britain anti-establishment punk rock. But just going to play some fun Clash. And it's not really a political one, Train in Vain, but I like it, so I'm going to play it because I can, and I hope you like it too. Train in Vain by The Clash.
Thank you.
back on CITR. This is Sarah Lapsley. You're listening to Are You Aware? So that was The Clash. We're talking about punk rock. And frankly, that doesn't really sound that punky to me. Like, Train in Vain is pretty poppy. But I don't know. Now, the Sex Pistols were more punk. They were formed in 1975. They're kind of, when we think of punk rock, we think of the Sex Pistols. And they were sort of a more anti-establishment band. So it turns out, I guess there's a whole thing in Britain. There is an establishment. And then so there's a history of people who are anti-establishment. So the Sex Pistols sort of were a part of this tradition. So anti-establishment figures and groups are seen as those who argue or act against the ruling class. So Britain is quite rigid, like, you know, from medieval times. So a feudal state, an established church, a monarchy, aristocracy, an unelected upper house and parliament. I'm not sure if they still have an unelected upper house. So people that aren't elected but are made up by hereditary nobles. So the rich ruling class had a stranglehold on society. And they didn't really, again, I'm out of my depth, I'm not going to lie, but they didn't, England didn't seem to have the same collapse of the ruling class that other countries did, like France and so on, or Russia, where the monarchy was overthrown. They kind of adjusted and gave up some of their power, but there was a strong establishment. And so people then, you know, through writing and satire and so on, were anti-establishment, and bands are sort of a part of that. But the Sex Pistols were more like, you know, they were just like out of control personally. They didn't have a targeted, deliberate agenda for social change. But they created social change just by being. And I love that in, I guess, what year is it? To correspond with the Queen's Silver Jubilee, after a bunch of things happened, they got kicked off their record label. In March 10th, 1977, at a press ceremony held outside Buckingham Palace, they publicly signed to A&M Records, but that fell through afterwards because Sid Vicious smashed in a toilet bowl and cut his foot. They ended up releasing it on Virgin Records, I guess. But it did correspond with the Queen's Silver Jubilee. So I have mixed feelings because I love the Queen, but she can take it. She can take a bit of scabrous lyrics. God save the Queen, she ain't no human being, and there's no future in England's dreaming. And so, you know, pretty awesome. And I'm going to play that because, I don't know, I want to. God save the Queen. Long live the Queen.
Fascist regime, it made you a moron.
how cool was that? The Sex Pistols, God Save the Queen. Like, they have this, I was just sort of watching the YouTube video of it, and they just look so cool. That is so awesome. I love them. I don't know, but that's about all I have to say about the Sex Pistols. But another sort of band that I found interesting was Crass, and I don't know anything about them before today. But I liked them because they were more the radical leftist utopian, and they were around at the same time, 1977, English punk rock band, which promoted anarchy as a political ideology, and they popularized the anarcho-punk movement. So as part of punk subculture, they were into direct action, animal rights, and environmentalism way before their time. They had sort of a do-it-yourself ethic, and they were kind of pranksters, and they would make sound collages, leaflets, albums, and films, kind of. So they spawned this whole, I guess, way of being that came over the pond to us. Crass spray-painted graffiti messages in the London Underground system and on advertising billboards, coordinated squats and political action. So I guess they were influential, I guess, over bands that kind of then did that. Like Fugazi or other bands like that. Sorry, I'm out of my depth. But they used a lot of icons of authority, like the Christian Cross and the Union Jack and the Ouroboros. Do you know what the Ouroboros is? I do, because I have it on my wall at home. It's like the snake eating itself, and I love that image. So I wanted to play some Crass. This song I read a little bit about. What did I read about it? That it was so upsetting, the song Asylum. Crass's first release was The Feeding of the 5,000, and that's a reference to the biblical story where Jesus turns a small basket of fish and bread into a giant meal for 5,000 people. Workers at the record pressing plant refused to handle the album due to the allegedly blasphemous content of the song Asylum, and the record was released without it. In its place were 2 minutes of silence entitled The Sound of Free Speech. After that, Crass set up their own record label. But both of those things were really interesting to me. Allegedly blasphemous content. I haven't heard Asylum, but I'm going to play it for you so we can see for ourselves. Also reminds me of being a teenager and my first album. I think I bought my very first was like the Fame soundtrack because I loved that show. But my first real music album was Depeche Mode. People Are People, I think the album. And there was a song, Blasphemous Rumors. It did not go well with my parents. And I thought they were so mean and horrible. I don't know if they took it away, but they really gave me a hard time. I also had an album, Skinny Puppy. They were I think they were based out of Vancouver, but like an industrial punk band. And they had this song, Brap, which was just people screaming. And my mother stole it away without my permission and broke it, because she said it sounded like people being tortured. So I understand what it's like to have music censored. So I'll play that in a second. But I liked the idea of the 2 minutes of silence. And I thought, well, maybe as kind of a shout out to, you know, political activism, I could have 2 minutes of silence on the radio, like right now. And then I thought about that and I thought that would be so cool. And I was like, I can't do that. I can't do 2 minutes of radio silence. Or can I? No, I can't, because some kind of alarm will go off and I'll get in trouble. But maybe I'll have an impromptu few seconds of silence later on in the show. But let's listen to Crass, Asylum, and see if it's as blasphemous as it apparently is. So here they are, Crass.
I am no feeble Christ, not me. He hangs in glib delight upon his cross above my body. Christ, forgive, forgive. I vomit for you, Jesu. Shit, forgive. Down now from your cross. Down now from your papal heights. From that churlish suicide. Petulant child. down from those pious heights, royal flag bearer, goat, Billy. I vomit for you. Forgive? Shit he forgives. He hangs in crucified delight, nailed to the extent of his vision, his cross, his manhood, violence, guilt, sin. He would nail my body upon his cross, suicide visionary, death reveler, rake, rapist, life fucker, Jesus.
Back on CITR, that was Crass, Asylum. So that album, that song didn't come out on the album, The Feeding of the 5,000, because the workers wouldn't, the pressing plant wouldn't press it because it was blasphemous. And I don't know if it's blasphemous. I mean, we've become pretty desensitized to blasphemous content. I think that's not a big deal. Although the swearing, that's a lot of swearing. I don't think this song probably gets very much airplay. But anyways, it was all right. But you know what else was interesting about Crass was the Thatcher Gate. So I guess they did some famous hoaxes. Another Crass hoax. Sorry, just having a moment by myself in the studio. Another Crass hoax was known as Thatcher Gate tapes, a recording of an apparently accidentally overheard telephone conversation due to cross lines. So the tape was constructed by Crass from edited recordings of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. So on the tape, they appear to discuss the sinking of the HMS Sheffield during the Falklands War and agree that Europe would be a good target for nuclear weapons in a conflict between the United States and Soviet Union. Copies were leaked to the press via a Dutch news agency during the 1983 general election campaign. The U.S. State Department and the British government believed the tape to be propaganda produced by the KGB. That was reported by the San Francisco Chronicle and the Sunday Times. Although the tape was produced anonymously, the Observer, newspaper, linked the tape with the band. Previously classified documents made public in January 2014, so just a few months ago. No, just a few days ago. Okay, let me re-say this. Just a few days ago, in January 2014, previously classified government documents revealed that the Prime Minister was aware of the tape and had discussed it with her cabinet. So it was kind of a big deal. Crass, Thatcher tapes, and I've got it here. Somebody kindly posted it on YouTube. I don't know what it's like in terms of audio quality, but let's just play it together.
More than a plane, ballistic missiles, and you will see that the United States forces remain deployed.
That was the Crass Hoax Thatchergate tape. That was cool. So they kind of successfully made people pay attention and get it reported in the news. There was sort of a transcript there. Obviously, they just had the voices edited, low audio. I did have a transcript of the actual thing in front of me, but it seems to have disappeared. So, oh well, let's move on. But that was cool. Crass. They've emerged as my favorite British punk band. But across the pond in the US, obviously, there were tons of punk bands in Canada as well. The Ramones were the biggest punk band to come out of the States, I guess. And they're not the brightest bulbs in the firmament. They didn't seem to have a political agenda to speak of. They're just kind of dudes having a good time. But I guess they influenced, or what little I read, they influenced the British bands a lot, stylistically and musically, because they are really cool, despite being kind of dopey. And I just wanted to play a Ramones song, one of my favorite Ramones songs that I've played before in CITR. And kind of a shout out, kind of link it to the climate change section at the end. I know people, I knew someone from work who was stranded for 5 days in New York, and she was just like, oh, it was so awful. I'm like, wow, I'd give my arm to be stranded in New York for 5 days. But I realized people were inconvenienced, and that sucks. And that's probably due to radical weather patterns, climate change. So if you're stuck in New York, what do? You go to 53rd and 3rd. Here's the Ramones.
No. Has mental illness or addiction touched your life? You might be interested in coming out to the Kaleidoscope, UBC's first and only student-created, peer-run mental health support group at the university's Vancouver campus. They offer a stigma-free place for people to share their stories with others going through similar experiences. The Kaleidoscope meets every week on Tuesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. at the Center for Student Involvement in Brock Hall.
Learn more at the-kaleidoscope.com.
We're back on CITR. Do check out the Kaleidoscope Mental Health Group if you have mental health issues. Support is a really important part of recovery. Finding out you're not alone, having a safe place to come and talk about what you're going through. And it's isolation, I think, that keeps people really stuck. They don't realize their experience is common, and so on. So definitely check that out. I'm a big supporter of mental health, as everyone knows. I went to a play, Medicine, about this sort of one-man play by this neurotic guy, and he sort of goes on a retreat with Dr. Gabor Mate and takes ayahuasca and sort of his journey to overcome neuroses. It was good. It was interesting. I have lots to say about it. I'll never take ayahuasca because it makes you throw up and you're trapped in a room with other people. If you do an ayahuasca retreat, I'll go over this again on the Arts Report next week, but if you do an ayahuasca retreat, you have to bring your own bucket because you will throw up. So you just sit in a circle of people and they barf into their buckets and then they have like a bad trip or a good trip. And I'm just like, yeah, you couldn't pay me. I was thinking, how much would someone have to pay me to do that? And I was thinking $5,000 is what you'd have to pay me to do that. It still wouldn't really be enough, but I would do it for $5,000. For $1,000, no way. No way. So I have lots to say about medicine. So tune into the Arts Report next January 22nd. But anyways, we're talking about punk rock, British punk rock, then just played the Ramones for fun. Obviously, there's a zillion punk rock bands in the States. And Canada has a good punk rock scene as well. And DOA is one of our great punk bands. And Joe Keithley is really awesome. Joey Shithead Keithley. So he's a punk rock legend, founder and lead singer of DOA, 4 decades as a professional musician. Now he's running and a hardcore punk band that had good political values and were really fun. And he ran for the Green Party in the early 2000s, and then he ran as a candidate for the BC NDP in the riding of Coquitlam-Burke Mountain. And I'm sad to say he lost. He had a great agenda. His top issue is education. So wants more special needs teachers, finding out ways to lower student loan debt, utilize his skill set to promote arts and make BC into a cultural destination. He's now 56, but he's had a great career. He urinated on stage. I don't know. That's pretty bad. Back in the day. But I don't know. I don't know. There's a book. I haven't read that book, of course. Otherwise I'd have something. You know what? I'm gonna not say anything. I'm gonna play DOA. We're driving to hell and back. So how about it? Let's drive to hell and back.
Like a woe, like a woe, gotta put your hand back, put down the wall. Even if I can't, then I'm a stone. Yeah, yeah, rain, but I'm fine in the storm.
That was DOA Driving to Hell and Back. So another punk band, they were more art punk. They didn't really have a political agenda. They were too cool for that, although they were politically liberal individually. And that's the U-Jerks. So I've played them before. A lot of famous people in the U-Jerks. So Jeff Wall, basically one of the most famous artists in the world, photographer. Rodney Graham, also one of the most famous artists in the world. David Wisdom, CBC radio host. My friend Colin Griffiths. So a bunch of people, late 70s, had a really cool project together. They were offered a major label contract, which they declined. They were too cool for that. But I'm playing this song, Eisenhower and the Hippies, because it's, I don't know, kind of political, but also because it's Rodney Graham's birthday. He's a good friend. He's been an important person in my life. He and his posse studio group just bought a bakery, Liberty Bakery, previously owned by this like 90-year-old woman named Liberty. They have, it's at Main and 21st. Definitely go there. They had the best black bean soup in the universe. Like, you could just live on that black bean soup. And they've taken it over just last week. So drop by. They're going to be making it the coolest place in Vancouver. I'm not allowed to go there due to ex-wives and so on. But I don't know. Anyways, go to their bakery. So here's the U-Jerks, Eisenhower and the Hippies. Happy birthday, Rodney. You're a senior citizen today. Take advantage of those senior citizen discounts.
Eisenhower and the Hippies. He's put that pussy. Eisenhower and the Hippies. Serenity.
Back on CITR, you're listening to Are You Aware? We're kind of doing punk rock things, and I'm kind of rambling and playing punk rock. But enough about Canada. So one thing that kind of came on my radar, sorry, not on my radar, but came on my radar for this show, it has been on everyone's radar, is Pussy Riot. So they were a band, a feminist collective, punk rock collective. And they pissed off the government of Russia in August 2012. Three members were convicted of hooliganism for staging a performance in a Moscow church. Each was sentenced to 2 years imprisonment. So people were really upset. Obviously, Russia has pretty horrible human rights record, a corrupt government, a corrupt society, poverty, a lot of problems. And I wasn't that sympathetic. I'm just being sort of honest about at first. I was like, I don't know why I wasn't that sympathetic, but I just hadn't thought it through that well. And maybe some sort of internalized sexism. I just thought, well, you know, if, you know, it's the Russian government, like, what do you expect? So I wasn't that sympathetic, which is unusual for me. And what was her name? Nadezhda Tolokonikov, sort of the face of Pussy Riot, which everyone recognizes, then did 2 years in prison. And what changed my mind about this was reading her open letter to the Guardian. She went on a hunger strike during her sentence, and I was actually shocked by what she had to say about what life in a penal colony is like. And I then felt a lot of respect and admiration for her for being a political activist and having the kind of guts and grits that I certainly don't have, most people don't have. So I'm just going to read some of her letter. So it says, beginning, and she's out now, which is a relief. Beginning Monday, 23rd of September, 2013, I'm going on a hunger strike. This is an extreme method, but I'm convinced it is my only way out of my current situation. The Penal Colony Administration refuses to hear me, but I, in turn, refuse to back down from my demands. I will not remain silent, resigned to watch as my fellow prisoners collapse under the strain of slavery-like conditions. I demand that the Colony Administration respect human rights. I demand that the camp, the Mordovia camp, function in accordance with the law. It has been a year since I arrived at the Penal Colony Number 14 in the Mordovian village of Parts. As the prisoner's saying goes, those who never did time in Mordovia never did time at all. So she was saying about it had a reputation, this camp, the highest levels of security, the longest workdays, and the most flagrant rights violations. When they send you off to Mordovia, it is as though you're heading to the scaffold. Until the very last moment, they keep you keep hoping, perhaps they won't send you to Mordovia after all. Maybe it will blow over. So she said, but nothing blew over. And in the autumn of 2012, I arrived at the camp on the banks of the Partsa River. Mordovia greeted me with the words of the deputy chief of the penal colony, Lieutenant Colonel Kuprinov, who is the de facto head of administrator of our colony. He said, you should know that when it comes to politics, I am a Stalinist. It's kind of frightening. A misfortune has befallen you. Isn't that so? You have been sentenced to 2 years in the colony. People usually change their minds when bad things happen to them. If you want to be paroled as soon as possible, you have to confess your guilt. If you don't, you won't get parole. I told him right away that I would only work the 8 hours a day required by the labor code. And he said, the code is one thing, but what really matters is fulfilling your quota. If you don't, you work overtime. You should know that we have broken stronger wills than yours. So then she talks about her job in the sewing shop. My brigade in the sewing shop works 16 to 17 hours a day from 7:30 a.m. to 12:30 a.m. At best, we get 4 hours of sleep a night. We have a day off once every month and a half. We work almost every Sunday. Prisoners submit petitions to work on weekends out of their own desire. In actuality, of course, there is no desire to speak of. These petitions are written on the orders of the administration and under pressure from the prisoners that help enforce it. So very toxic betrayal bond between the people with power and the people that don't have power. No one dares to disobey these orders and not submit such petitions regarding entering the work zone on Sunday, which means that working until 1 a.m., so then she gives some examples of people that were ill and asked to leave, but they were pushed into more work. So she talks about unofficial punishments. Prisoners are forced to stay in a fenced-off passageway until lights out, so they can't go into the barracks. So it could be in the middle of winter, freezing conditions. So it's a torture. So one woman ended up getting such bad frostbite when she was sort of locked in this open area. They had to amputate her fingers and one of her feet. People lose their hygiene privileges. They can't use the bathroom or wash themselves. It sounds like an insane violation of human rights. They don't get enough food. And it is slave labor, so they do all the sewing and then it's sold, and that's how the camp makes their money. It's a very long letter. And they arbitrarily increase their workload, make it this sort of unmanageable workload that no human could do. A threatening, anxious atmosphere pervades the work zone. Eventually sleep-deprived, overwhelmed by the endless race to fulfill inhumanely large quotas, prisoners are always on the verge of breaking down, screaming at each other, fighting over the smallest things. Just recently, a young woman got stabbed in the head with a pair of scissors because she didn't turn in a pair of pants on time. Another tried to cut her own stomach open with a hacksaw. They stopped her. So thankfully, she was released and spoke out about these conditions, but that's scary because right now, many people are in a Russian prison suffering, and I'm just not sure why we do that to each other. It's scary to me. And just, you know, over here, conditions are more humane, but we still have too many people incarcerated. In Canada, prison population is at an all-time high. Those are disproportionately often people like Aboriginal people. In the United States, 2,267,000 adults are incarcerated in U.S. federal and state prisons. That's really scary. Plus 70,792 juveniles. Although debtors' prisons no longer exist in the United States, residents of some U.S. states can still be incarcerated for debt, so pay off your credit cards. And I guess this is kind of a segue. Well, first I'm going to play Pussy Riot, because that's why I talked about Pussy Riot. I'm going to play this song. It's called Putin Lights Up the Fires. It's a music video, so I don't know what it sounds like. But this one goes out to the girls from Pussy Riot. I'm sorry that you went through this horrible experience, and I'm very proud of you for standing up for women's rights and the rights of human beings in Russia. It's going to start. There we go.
Ушим щеки, как руки чувак. Нас нельзя закупорить ящик. Зажигающий гид нам лучше чаще. Путин зажигает, как в революции. Невозможно и страшно с людьми в тишине. Прикать на него, то гнилая рябина. Что не срок много лет, то предмет для полюции.
cool is that? Pussy Riot. You should see that video too. Putin lights up the fires. They're like really hot chicks wrestling kind of in a prison setting. Prison fantasy, hot prison fantasy. So let's segue into our section on psychopaths. I'm a little bit more on my own turf. People like psychopaths. I don't personally like psychopaths. Rather, people are interested in psychopaths. I'm personally not that interested in psychopaths. I think they're really boring. And hopefully I can explain why. But we're interested in them because they do horrible things. And we know somehow that they're different from ourselves. And they are different from ourselves. But there's been a lot of writing and hype about psychopathy. And so I'm going to speak a little bit about the pure psychopath. And then we'll talk about a little bit about the kind of snakes in suits. So the pure psychopath is someone who's a criminal psychopath. Their psychopathy is so extreme that they actually cannot function in society. They're kind of by definition criminals because they're so predatory and violent that they really inevitably do things that cause them to be in conflict with the law, and oftentimes they just need to be incarcerated. And in fact, they often do very well in incarceration because of the structure and the hierarchy. They fit very well into it. But there's also what we call snakes in suits. And there's a good book by Robert Hare. And that's, we've identified type of people that have some psychopathic characteristics, but they do very well in Western society. They do well in business. They do well in as CEOs. And you find them in various professions, including the media. And so there's been a lot of writing about those type of people. But just to introduce you to the construct of psychopathy, these are just notes. A friend of mine gave a presentation a long time ago, and I saw it, and I became fascinated, and it got me into the idea of working in with people like this, and now I do. So it was kind of meant to be, I guess. But a quote from her presentation says, this is a psychopath in his own words, describing what it's like to be a psychopath. He will choose you, disarm you with his words, control you with his presence. He will delight you with his wit and plans. He will show you a good time, but you will always get the bill. And when he is through with you, and he will be through with you, he will desert you. That's kind of nasty. So psychopaths are not mad according to psychiatric standards. Their acts result not from a deranged mind, but from a cold, calculating rationality. I think the first person who in the 19th century sort of identified psychopaths was a French person whose name shouldn't escape me, but is basically madness without the madness. So you don't have the disordered thinking or the highly imaginative, disturbed thinking of someone who's schizophrenic or someone who's sick with bipolar. They are rational, but their intense rationality is what makes them insane. So they do think it's mostly genetic. The home life can have an impact for better or for worse, but it really has to do with structural differences in the brain. So the parts of our brain that make us sensitive to others, that make it rewarding for us to interact with others, aren't present in the psychopath. And so a lot of the most famous work on psychopathy has been done right here at UBC. But there's by Dr. Robert Hare, really famous guy, interesting. One of his best books on the topic is called Without Conscience. I highly recommend it. But there's different dimensions or and so all these qualities need to be present for someone to be called a psychopath. So the first one is glibness or superficial charm, witty and articulate, amusing, entertaining, conversationalist, can tell unlikely but convincing stories, but they can be too slick or too smooth. If they're really good, they'll be so good at that you won't pick it up. But usually we get a sense that it's a little bit too slick. grandiosity, so narcissistic and grossly inflated view of their self-worth and importance, sense of entitlement, see themselves as superior beings who are justified in living according to their own rules, arrogant, shameless braggarts. So I've experienced this, they're like, I'm so fantastic, I'm brilliant, I have a super high IQ. And I'm like, really? Because you're sitting in a prison. Pathological lying. This is interesting, and it's a real tell. So they will lie, but they're not necessarily good liars, but like in terms of the information they present. So they'll present something and then a minute later contradict it, and you'll kind of catch them out and say, like you just said this, but now you're saying this. And they're like, oh yeah, like they brush it off. So that's a real tell that they get caught in lies, but they just brush it off. They don't experience any tension. And that's why they pass the polygraphs really well. They don't have fear or tension. Conning and manipulative, lack of remorse, shallow emotions. They call them proto-emotions. So these kind of primitive emotional responses, but they're not the complex feeling tones that regular people have. Need for stimulation, prone to boredom. Parasitic lifestyle, use others for their own gain, use others for financial support. Poor behavioral control, promiscuous sexual behavior, lack of realistic long-term goals, impulsivity, irresponsibility, juvenile delinquency, early behavior problems, criminal versatility, antisocial and illegal activities that are more varied and frequent than those of other criminals. So people might be like a car thief and that's the only thing they do. Whereas a psychopath will do a multiple, they're very good at being criminals. Lots of different types of crimes, lots of different motivations for types of crimes. So that's your typical criminal psychopath. And again, often they do well in incarceration because they fit into the prison culture. It's very much a hierarchy. So they sit generally at the top of the prison culture. They get their needs met. And I've found that one thing that works well with psychopaths, like regular therapy does not work. And everybody knows that. You just can't do therapy with them. But one thing that does work is structured activities. So like giving them jobs. They often work very hard at jobs. But for the ones who are very high on all of those things that I just mentioned, they do need to kind of be put away. So one psychopath that's famous is Charles Manson. And I read the article in the Rolling Stone. I thought it was kind of, I don't know, not a great article. Like the author was a little bit over the top. But Charlie Manson is serving out the rest of a life sentence for his part in the Tate-LaBianca slayings in 1969. And so the way he talks, the quotes in this interview, you can tell he's kind of psychopathic. But he's interesting because he also seems to have a mental illness. He does maybe have some kind of bipolar disorder as well. And that's rare, but it does happen in percentage of cases. So people have psychopathy plus a delusional disorder. Because he is more imaginative, I would say, more creative than the average psychopath. He spent the past 44 years in prison and nearly 60 years incarcerated altogether. So he spent less than 2 decades of his life a free man. And he's sort of married this girl. Like, what's interesting to me about him is that he actually manages, I guess, through his fame and reputation to attract followers still. And this poor girl that he married in prison, she looks so lost. So she comes and visits him in prison and brings him things. But he said a lot of typical things. He's very typical prisoner. Involved in sexual activity in prison, kind of getting his needs met. He kind of tries to psych out the writer in a really dumb way. He says, Charlie sighs and takes a seat, seemingly lost and befuddled. But then, before I know it, he's reached out and bounced one of his fingers off the tip of my nose, fast as a frog's tongue. He leans forward. I can feel his breath in my ear. So this is Charles Manson speaking. I've touched everyone on the nose, man. There ain't nobody I can't touch on the nose. He tilts his head to one side and says, I know what you're thinking. Just relax. A while later, he says, if I can touch you, I can kill you. Really? I don't think so. So he's actually successful at psyching people out. You know, so don't let these guys psych you out. I wouldn't let Charlie psych me out. I would say, don't touch my on the nose, and I'm going to pull my alarm, and you're going to get taken away. But anyways, here's a song, you know, and Charles Manson, maybe if he had made it as a singer, he wouldn't have become a murderer, sort of a thwarted artist, but he probably would have. He's a troubled individual, and I think he belongs in prison. So that's what I have to say on it. This is his song, Close to Me.
Let's see. Would you mind if I approach you with this song? May I tell you that I've watched you, how very long that I've watched you from afar, and now right here you are so close to me. Now I know it isn't proper to insist, but my heart would not allow me to resist. So forgive me if I'm bold, but my story must be told close to you. I'm not pretending that I'm perfect. I am nothing with no vanity, but I want you and I need you. Can't you see you're just a part of me? So just sit there for a moment while I sing, and remember with each note is love that I bring. And if you enjoy the song, then it's here that you belong, close to me.
I got a bunch of other songs that other people could sing that that I don't agree with. I wrote them. I got some songs that other people could sing very well, you know.
You do whatever you feel, man.
Just yeah, well, then I won't do it.
Whatever comes in your mind.
Yeah, all right. Yeah.
Why don't you do some of the songs that you wrote in prison, man?
Yeah, just the ones that are sad, man. You know.
Groovy, let's get to some sad songs, man. Let's do it. Let's groove to some sad things. I'm down.
All right. Well,
I'm down and you're up.
Yes. Whichever way that is.
Hi, we're back on CITR. That was Charles Manson. That was a cool song. Close to Me. Way to go, Charles Manson. So we're back talking about psychopaths on CITR 101.9 FM. So I got this book at Christmas, you know, shopping for people, and then I just bought stuff for myself until the last minute when I ended up having to buy things for other people. And this book is called The Wisdom of Psychopaths: What Saints, Spies, and Serial Killers Can Teach Us About Success. And it's by Dr. Kevin Dutton. He's a professor in social psychology at the University of Cambridge. He regularly publishes in leading international scientific journals and speaks at conferences. So, I don't know, I'm picky about these kind of books, but I liked this book a lot. It's a fun read, so I do recommend it. It's a bit all over the place. So he's very, very, very excited about psychopaths and gives a lot of interesting kind of case studies and makes a lot of interesting points about psychopaths. And he even goes a step beyond in terms of analyzing, you know, the psychopathic personality and suggesting how regular folks can be more psychopathic and hence more successful. So it's an interesting read, although I think he's off the mark significantly in places. But this idea of snakes in suits, so people that have psychopathic characteristics but don't commit overt criminal activity and get away with a lot. So these people, I mean, there's degrees. Some people are just successful. Other people are managed to stay successful, but they create a lot of damage around them. So people like CEOs. And so he draws parallels, like he gives, but he, so, you know, there's been a lot of talk about snakes in suits, but he, I think, uncovers something interesting. Is that, so he gives the example of a lawyer who's like totally a vicious, cold, ruthless lawyer. And he has a woman on the stand who's like a rape victim, and he cross-examines her and like slays her. And then goes and has lunch and is like, totally doesn't give it a second thought that he's basically psychologically destroyed this woman on the stand. Yet this same man then goes to a store to return a garment that his wife has bought. And he's like totally wimpy, like he can't even assert himself in front of the sales clerk. So he's kind of saying, what's interesting about these people is that they're psychopathic in certain contexts, like in a work context, but then they're kind of regular folks outside of that context. And he suggests that this is something we could all adopt more of in order to be successful at work, which I think is kind of a flawed premise, but it's interesting. So he says, core psychopathic traits can sometimes morph into the star qualities characteristic of an influential leader. And in order to assess the presence of such traits, with due sensitivity to context, it becomes imperative to ask the right questions. So he talks about psychopathic traits like superficial charm, grandiosity, manipulation, con artistry, impulsivity, thrill seeking, and then contrast them with leadership traits, which are similar but more positive, like charisma, self-confidence, ability to influence, persuasive, visionary thinking, ability to take risks. So when we call it like negative risk taking or impulsivity, yet risk taking can be positive if it's applied correctly in the right context. So I think it's an important point. But again, I don't agree necessarily with like us all becoming more psychopathic. And then they talk about an optimal level. Like if you're like, this sort of bell curve thing, or the Yerkes-Dodson law thing of like, if you have very low psychopathy, you kind of don't do very well because you're too wimpy and you get walked on. If you have very high psychopathy, you don't do very well because you just operate on the fringes of society and become incarcerated and dangerous. But with a kind of optimal level of psychopathy, you actually are at the highest level of functioning, according to him, career-wise. But that's in Western society. When, like, you want to be successful in Western society, which has questionable values to begin with. But another kind of point that he makes is a capacity, like aside from the personality traits of the psychopath, like shallowness and glibness and narcissism, they have physical traits that are very interesting. They are not responsive to fear. They, if you give them polygraph tests, they perform very well. They don't have anxiety. They don't sweat. That's how they can get away with doing these things. And he's saying some people, like surgeons or people that work as emergency first responders, have the same trait. Now, I don't think that means they're psychopathic, which he kind of hints at. I think it means that some people have this ability to have a very low responsiveness to high intensity events, and it doesn't have anything to do with someone's personality. So I just want to make that point. Robin just walked by. I'm kind of gabbing away. And so he then goes on to say, to try to draw a parallel, and I don't think he does it as well as he could have if he had taken more time, but tries to draw a parallel between people that are very spiritual and people that are psychopathic. So people that are psychopathic are emotionally detached. People like Tibetan monks are emotionally detached. And they also have this uncanny ability, and he talks about in the book, the Tibetan monks, to be non-responsive to physical stimuli. They did an experiment where they shot a gun, like, right in the ear of Tibetan monks, and they didn't flinch in this state of deep meditation, which even a psychopath would, you can't, you know, anyone's going to have a physiological response to a gunshot. So I think it was, like, a little weak in kind of trying to draw the full circle between the saint and the psychopath, but he tried. But I'm just going to pull up a song that he talked about. And that this is actually what got me excited about doing the punk rock and psychopaths. So Gary Gilmore was, I'm just going to find it in the book here. He was an American psychopath. One of criminal history's super psychopaths, a rare subbreed of the species with all the dials on the mixing deck turned up to max. In January of 1977, right when the punk scene was burgeoning, the former shoe salesman was executed by a firing squad in the small and otherwise unremarkable town of Draper, Utah. The previous July, at a gas station a few miles up the road, he'd gunned down an attendant for reasons he wasn't quite sure of, and then he'd gone to a movie with his girlfriend. The next day, as an encore, he'd shot a motel clerk in the head. 6 months later, after a final repast of hamburgers, eggs, and potatoes, he was facing the firing squad in the Utah State Prison. There were five in the firing squad. The prison warden tightened the leather straps around Gilmore's head and chest and fixed a circular cloth target over his heart. He then withdrew from the execution chamber. So they were wondering if there would be a reprieve. There wasn't. So before, as is tradition, pulling a black corduroy hood over his head, the warden asked Gilmore if there were any last words. Gilmore stared straight ahead, his eyes colder than a great white shark's. I don't know how the author really knows that. As the inaudible thunder of death rumbled across his soul. So a little bit histrionic to me. Let's do it. That was Gary Gilmore's last word. So following his execution, Gilmore, like, he had requested as his final request in his will that his eyes be used for transplant purposes. Within hours of his death, in compliance with his wishes, two people received his corneas. So they got Gary Gilmore's eyes. And so a punk rock band, The Adverts, wrote a song called Gary Gilmore's Eyes. And I'm going to play it for you now.
To a private water reel.
Hey, that was Gary Gilmore's Eyes by the Adverts. I think I left my mic on, so I was, like, typing. But, yeah, psychopaths, punk rock, are you aware? We're kind of heading into the final zone, but I just wanted to keep sharing with you from The Wisdom of Psychopaths by Kevin Dutton. So he had this idea on the subway, and he wrote it down, and I think it's kind of the core idea of the book, but he was, like, too excited, my sense was, to share it. He didn't want to go into it. And perhaps he questioned, like, academics are actually probably a few snakes in suits, and academia, they're very, very driven by finding something new. And when they find something new, it's like, oh, it's like their idea. And so he has this new idea, like I said before, about that we should all be a little more psychopathic, and this will help us succeed in the world. So he said he created the template for the SOS mentality, the psychological skill set to strive, overcome, and succeed. I label the skill set, this is Kevin Dutton speaking, the seven deadly wins, seven core principles of psychopathy that, apportioned judiciously and applied with due care and attention, can help us get exactly what we want. Can help us respond rather than react to the challenges of modern day living, can transform our outlook from victim to victor, but without turning us into a villain. I don't know. It did frighten me, this book, because I realized there's a lot of psychopaths out there. We're talking about 1% of the population, and only a very few of those are the type of extreme criminals like Charles Manson. And the rest of them are in high-level positions, and they've kind of snuck by the nice ones, the rest of us. And so in that sense, I was like, yeah, maybe we should be a little more psychopathic and get the real psychopaths off of the, you know, their high horse. So here's the seven deadly wins, core principles that we should apply in our own lives in order to strive, overcome, and succeed. 1, ruthlessness. 2, charm. 3, focus. 4, mental toughness. 5, fearlessness. 6, mindfulness. 7, action. And he does acknowledge it's important how you apply it. So I kind of rewrote these. I was like, yeah, I like it. But number 1, ruthlessness has to go. We need less ruthlessness, not more. But I'm going to change that to assertiveness, Kevin Dutton. Apply assertiveness in your daily life and you will win friends and also succeed and get your needs met. 2, charm. I don't like it. It sounds kind of manipulative. I like to change that to charisma. Because charisma is really about paying attention to other people and being curious about other people and giving your energy to other people. And that makes people want to give back to you, which is nice. So assertiveness, charisma, focus, I like it. Mental toughness, I don't know. I'd say resilience is more important than mental toughness. So being able to take hits and come back from them, to know what you need and to work towards it in an ethical way. Fearlessness, yes, I think that's good. Mindfulness, definitely. And action. We can all stand to take action. So that's what I have to say about that. I'm going to sort of head into wrapping up because we've got Darren Gall coming in next with a great show. So I wanted to just finish with a poem that's at the end of this book. And it is called, it's a poem about moths. But it's also a poem about psychopaths. I don't know who the author is. I think it's by Don Marquis. I don't know. I was talking to a moth the other evening. He was trying to break into an electric light bulb and fry himself on the wires. Why do you fellows pull this stunt? I asked him. Because it's the conventional thing for moths? Or why, if that had been an uncovered candle instead of an electric light bulb, you would now be a small, unsightly cinder. Have you no sense? Plenty of it, he answered, but at times we get tired of using it. We get bored with the routine and crave beauty and excitement. Fire is beautiful, and we know that if we get too close it will kill us. But what does that matter? It is better to be happy for a moment and be burned up with beauty than to live a long time and be bored all the while. So we wad all our life up into one little roll, and then we shoot the roll. That is what life is for. It is better to be a part of beauty for one instance and then cease to exist than to exist forever and never be a part of beauty. Our attitude towards life is come easy, go easy. We are all like human beings used to be before they became too civilized to enjoy themselves, and before I could argue him out of his philosophy, he went and immolated himself on a patent cigar lighter. I do not agree with him. Myself, I would rather have half the happiness and twice the longevity. But at the same time, I wish there was something I wanted as badly as he wanted to fry himself. So that's it. I'm going to sign off. But Kevin Dutton did talk a lot about Tibetan monks and some of their qualities that were similar to psychopaths. So detachment, low physical arousal. So I'm going to leave you off with pure sounds of the Gyoto monks of Tibet. They're saying a mandala offering. Love it. Darren Gall's on next with his show, and I'll be back on the Arts Report January 22nd. Good night. Thanks for listening.
What? Radio.